This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present A Time of Love and Tartan, a 44 Scotland Street novel by Alexander McCall Smith, narrated by Robert Ian McKenzie. Chapter 1. An Invitation to the Elephant House. When Pat McGregor received an invitation from Bruce Anderson to meet him for coffee at the Elephant House on George the Fourth Bridge, her first reaction was to delete it. That is one of the great advantages of electronic communications. One can simply delete them. And one can do the same to people, in their electronic incarnation, of course. At the press of a button, or the equivalent, one can send them off into some vast soup of disassembled digital data, reducing them to floating ones and zeros, consigned to a Dantean world of echoes, a shadowy underworld of fading impulses. And that, thought Pat, was the fate that Bruce so richly deserved. A few years earlier, he had played with her affections as he had toyed with those of so many other young women, believing that to pay attention to this rather shy young student of art history was to confer on her a benison for which, if she knew anything about the world, she should be profoundly grateful. The expression, God's gift to women, came into all this somewhere. It was usually uttered sarcastically, as in, he thinks he's God's gift to women, but in Bruce's case, this was exactly what he did think of himself. In his view, he was one of those people who existed to give pleasure to others, not through anything he actually did, although that, of course, entered into it, but simply by being. Auden said that the blessed had no reason to care from what angle they were regarded, having nothing to hide. This was true of Bruce. Whether you looked at him from the front, the back, or from either side, the inescapable conclusion was that he was egregiously good-looking. As he pointed out to Catriona, a young woman with whom he once visited Florence, "There's a statue of my double in this city, you know." She had looked puzzled. "Your double, Bruce? Here in Florence?" Bruce smirked. "Yes, right here. Would you like to see it?" She nodded. This was some sort of game, she suspected, but then Bruce was so playful. That was one of the things that attracted her to him, his playfulness. That, and, of course, the way he made a girl feel special. Now that was a very considerable talent. And then there was his hair gel, that strange clove-scented potion that tickled her nose when she smelled it, and added, in such a curious way, an erotic charge to the most mundane of situations. Bruce and Catriona had already visited the Uffizi and had stood for some minutes before Botticelli's Birth of Venus before Bruce said, "That's Venus, you know. That's her standing in the shell." Catriona nodded. "She's very beautiful, isn't she?" Bruce thought about this for a few moments before he replied. "Her neck's a bit long, but yes, she's beautiful, all right." Then, after a short pause, he'd observed, "Beauty's an interesting thing, isn't it? You either have it, or you don't, and that's all there is to it." Catriona looked at Bruce. He returned her gaze with all the confidence of one who knew that he stood on the right side of the divide he had just described. That was in the Uffizi. Now they found themselves in the Galleria dell'Accademia, looking up at Michelangelo's great masterpiece, the towering statue of David. "There," said Bruce. "Feast your eyes on that." The contemplation of Michelangelo's David is not easy for everybody, but Catriona looked.
"Look alike," whispered Bruce.
She stared at the line of David's nose and brow. It was undoubtedly Bruce. Her eye followed the sweep of his arms and the musculature of his torso, and she had to admit it. Bruce could have been Michelangelo's young model.
"I don't tell everybody about this," confided Bruce, "but I remember when I first saw a photograph of David, I thought, geez, that's me. I was about 16 at the time, in Crieff. I was at Morrison's, you know. And one of the girls in the class stuck a picture of David up in a corridor and wrote underneath it, 'Bruce Anderson.' It was so immature, but somehow... Pat, of course, had soon detected Bruce's narcissism, but in her state of infatuation, for that, she acknowledged, was what it was, she'd persuaded herself that his self-obsession was a harmless quirk, a hangover from adolescence, a passing phase. After all, there were plenty of young females who were just as fascinated by their appearance, spending hours in front of the mirror. It was more unusual amongst males, perhaps, but what was sauce for the goose should surely be sauce for the gander. If women were to indulge themselves in the contemplation of their own beauty, then why should men not do the same? For a few months she had circled Bruce, caught in his gravitational field as a moon might be in that of a planet, until at last she managed to extricate herself. When that happened, her father's relief at her escape had been palpable.
"Men like that are very dangerous," he said to her. "The only thing to do is to tear yourself away. Believe me, I've seen it in so many of my patients."
Pat's father, Dr. McGregor, a self-deprecating and scholarly man, was a psychiatrist and was particularly close to his daughter. He and Pat's mother had divorced after she'd gone off to restore a walled garden in Perthshire and had never returned. He had done nothing to deserve the desertion, but had been generous in his response.
"Your mother has found herself elsewhere," he explained to Pat. "Il faut cultiver notre jardin, as Candide, I think, pointed out. The important thing is her self-fulfillment. That's all that counts."
But there was something else that counted for him, and that was Pat's own happiness. He doted on his daughter, and when he realized that she'd taken up with Bruce, he'd been tipped into depression. At the end of Pat's affair with Bruce, an end that he, at least, had realized was inevitable, he'd tried to explain to her that however low she might feel after the breakup, it was as nothing when compared with the risk she would take in staying with him. And that was why, when she received this invitation to meet Bruce in the Elephant House, Pat said nothing about it to her father, and it was also why she almost deleted it from her email inbox without a reply. Almost, but not quite. She moved the cursor to hover over the delete symbol, hesitated, and then moved it to reply.
"See you there," she wrote.
She added no emoticon, for what emoticon is there to express anticipation of the sort she was feeling? Chapter 2. On George the Fourth Bridge. Pat arrived at the Elephant House before Bruce. She had not planned it that way. He'd suggested 10:30 in the morning, and she had lingered slightly in Forest Road so as to be at the café at 10:45. This was a stratagem to show him that she was not at his beck and call, and that even if she had agreed to meet him, she was not that eager to do so. It failed, however, as Bruce didn't get there until shortly after 11. When she found that he was yet to arrive, she briefly toyed with the idea of leaving. To do so would at least be to heed the advice, even if rather tardily, of her friend Janice, with whom she had discussed Bruce's invitation. Janice's views were very clear.
"Don't," she counselled. "Just don't. I'm only going to meet him for coffee."
Pat was not allowed to finish.
"Coffee? You know what coffee leads to?"
Her friend uttered the word coffee as one might utter cocaine, as if a whole hinterland of warning, of decline, of Hogarthian dissipation lay behind the word.
"You see," Janice continued, "you should never, never take up with an ex. Everybody knows that. Everybody. Everybody."
Janice had a way of repeating words, or verbally italicizing them, that added a certain melodramatic force to what she said.
"Do they? Of course they do. The reason why an ex tries to get in touch is always, always to get something from you. Never, never to give. So the only thing to say to an ex is, 'Your history.
You're the distant past.
Pat had wondered whether there might not be cases where an ex merely wanted to meet as, dare she say it, a friend.
No, Janice was adamant on that. As a friend, Pat, get real. Men don't do friendship.
Oh, come on. There are plenty of men who do friendship. Janice shook her head.
But not exes. Exes do dependence. They do recrimination. They do insincere attempts to get you back temporarily because they need a partner for a ball or something like that.
Or to ask for money.
That's what exes do, Pat. And if you go to meet this guy, this Bruce, at the Elephant House, then you're toast. You're on a plate. Bruschetta.
Pat had wavered and had almost taken Janice's advice, but had eventually decided to meet Bruce in spite of it. The whole point of seeking advice, at least for some, is to get somebody to confirm what you have already decided to do, and Pat had decided that she would meet Bruce. It would just be for coffee, and it would be a single meeting. If he asked her out, she would come up with some reason for saying no. She could even use that time-honored pretext of having to wash her hair. That was an excuse that was still occasionally used as a signal to a man that he had no chance and was, in a way, the ultimate put-down. Even Bruce, she felt, would understand that. And yet, did she really want to wash her hair? She found a table at the back of the cafe near the window. From there, looking out over Candlemaker Row, she saw the roofs of the grass market and against the skyline, the castle. The cafe itself was busy. It attracted a young crowd, a mixture of locals, students, and others, with a chattering presence of foreign teenagers. Pat was at an age where she was unaccustomed to feeling older than those around her, but here she did. She was now 25, the point at which 18 and 19-year-olds suddenly start to look straight through one. Invisibility to the young, of course, is a quality that grows slowly. By 30, one is beginning to get fainter. By 40, one is starting to disappear. And by 50, the metaphorical hill has been crossed, and one is simply no longer there. This manifested itself in the conversation that was taking place at a neighbouring table between a boy and a girl of 18 or 19. They seemed oblivious to Pat's presence, only a few feet away and well within earshot, and were discussing the slovenly habits of the boy's absent flatmate.
"His room stinks," he said.
"He stinks," she agreed.
"I can't stand it when people stink. You know, we owe it to other people not to stink. It's a sort of, civic duty."
"Yep. Don't stink. You'd think people would get it, wouldn't you? After all, which part of don't stink doesn't he understand?"
Pat stared out of the window, trying to insulate herself from this unwelcome exchange. Why had Bruce contacted her? Did he want to ignite old fires? She would not allow that. She simply would not. She knew that he was not good for her, and anyway, she was no longer interested in the sort of short-term relationship that Bruce went in for. But what if he had changed? What if he had matured and was now prepared for longer-term commitment? What then? Could she see herself with him again, giving him a second chance? People did change. They grew up. They stopped being selfish. They thought more of other people's feelings. Sometimes, in the case of males, this change happened quite late, at 28 and even beyond. Or so she'd read. In fact, she'd seen something in a magazine recently that suggested that some men didn't mature, fully mature, until they were well into their 30s. Bruce could be one of those, perhaps. He was now 28 or thereabouts, or was he even 30? Her train of thought was again disturbed by the conversation at the neighbouring table.
"You know what? He hardly ever changes his socks. No, I'm not making this up, but I think he wears them for 4 or 5 days, and then he leaves them lying on the floor. He has these ghastly trainers. You should see them. You'd want to throw up, I swear you would. He's disgusting.
How can you bear to live with him? Why don't the rest of you throw him out?
He owns the flat.
Oh, well, I suppose that makes a difference.
Yes, it does.
Pat smiled. The world was a difficult place. One had to hold one's nose, metaphorically, of course, but sometimes otherwise, too.
Chapter 3. Bruce irritates Pat, but only to an extent.
Patikins!
She looked up to see Bruce standing at the end of the table, smiling at her. Her irritation at being addressed by the childish sobriquet was intense, but didn't last for more than a few seconds. One had to forgive Bruce. It was impossible to be angry with somebody like him, with his clove-scented hair gel, his narcissism, his incorrigibility, his breezy self-confidence, his propensity to infantilize the names of others. He bent forward and kissed her on the cheek. There was a strong scent of cloves.
"I know I'm late," he said as he sat down opposite her at the table. "But I knew you'd wait."
Pat frowned. How did Bruce know that she would wait? Was she the sort of person who could be expected to wait because she had nothing better to do, or because, even if she would not normally wait, she would always wait for Bruce? To paraphrase Charles de Gaulle, who said, to those who urged him to take action against the inflammatory rhetoric of Jean-Paul Sartre, that one did not imprison Voltaire, one does not stand up Bruce, no matter how late he may be. But she simply could not let him imagine that she had nothing better to do than sit in the Elephant House and wait for him.
"I was about to go," she said.
She wanted to sound firm, but the words came out almost apologetically.
"Where?"
he asked casually.
"Are you working today?"
Pat helped Matthew in his gallery in Dundas Street, but only on 3 days a week.
"No."
Again, it was not the answer she had intended, but Pat was truthful, and whatever the stakes for her self-esteem, she could not tell a barefaced lie.
"Then that's all right," said Bruce.
"It is not all right," she thought. "It is not."
But she said instead,
"It's good to see you."
Bruce inclined his head as if to acknowledge an act of homage. Of course it was good to see him. He had been good to see for as long as he could remember. Even as a small boy he'd attracted admiration for his looks. The cherub had become an angel, had become a youth from a Giotto painting, had become a matinee idol.
"So," he said, "how's Patsy?"
This was a complex offence. Bruce had an irritating habit of referring to people, in their presence, in the third person. That was count one. Then there was the diminution of Pat's name. That was count two. And finally, there was the question of a possible play on the word patsy, as used in the argot of fraud. The patsy was the victim. Was that what Bruce was implying? She decided it wasn't. If Bruce employed wordplay, it was not that sophisticated.
"I'm all right," she said.
He reached across the table and patted her hand gently.
"Good,"
he said.
"And you were about to ask how I was, weren't you?"
"Was I?"
He winked.
"I think you were. Well, there's nothing wrong with me. Rien. But I could do with a cup of coffee."
He paused.
"Are you going to go and get something for yourself?"
Pat seethed.
"What do you want?"
she asked. This was intended to be a question about the point of their meeting. Bruce clearly wanted something.
"Thanks," said Bruce. "I need to make a phone call. I'll do that while you're fetching. I hope you don't mind. I'll have a latte, semi-skimmed if pos. I'll keep the table."
Pat caught her breath. She wanted to storm out. She wanted to tell this outrageous man that his charms would no longer work on her. That she saw through everything, through the hair gel, through the banter, through every arrogant assumption about female psychology, through the whole outrageous act, she saw right through it. But instead she asked him whether he took sugar.
"Niet,"
Bruce replied, "No sugar, thanks." Then he added, "I thought you'd remember that. You know, from the old days."
As she stood at the counter, waiting to be served, Pat reflected on what Bruce had just said. It was typical of his solipsism that he should imagine that she would remember every little detail of his preferences. Who would possibly remember, after some years, whether or not somebody else took sugar? If the other person was immensely important, of course, one might remember a little detail like that. If one went to tea with the Pope, for example, one might say, years after the event, "He doesn't take sugar in his coffee, you know." Or he might make some small remark about something very insignificant. And one would remember that, with all the clarity with which important events can be incised into memory, such as the Pope said that his watch wasn't keeping very good time, something like that. To which, of course, the reply might be that the watch of such a personage is calibrated in centuries rather than minutes and hours. She waited her turn. Two young Japanese women were ahead of her, talking to one another in hushed tones. One of them glanced at Pat and smiled. It was a tiny feeler of empathy, and she felt it touch her briefly, a flicker of warmth. They were strangers to her, far, she thought, from everything that was familiar to them, visiting this café for its literary associations. They were pilgrims, in a sense, not all that different in their quest from those who went to a religious shrine, to a grotto where some manifestation was said to have occurred a long time ago, or to a riverbank where the water was in some way holy and capable of washing away all the pains and cares and grubbiness of our ordinary lives. She took the tray with two coffees back to the table. Bruce had finished his call and was tucking his phone back into his pocket. His tone, when he spoke, was businesslike. "Right," he said. "You'll be wondering why I wanted to see you. Here's the imp. I'm going to be setting myself up in business." He smiled at her and told her what he had planned. Then came the proposition. "And I want you, Pat, to work with me. How about it?" She stared at him. "Are you serious?" she asked. "I mean, as in serious?"
Chapter 4. Those Things for Which We're Grateful. While Pat and Bruce had their conversation in the Elephant House, Bertie Pollock, aged 7, sat in his classroom at the Steiner School, looking out of its west-facing window. He knew it faced west, as he had recently acquired a compass from his friend, Ranald Braveheart MacPherson. In turn, Ranald had been given it as a present by his godfather, who'd forgotten that he'd given exactly the same present the year before, and even the year before that.
"You have this one, Bertie," said Ranald. "It's jolly important to have a compass. If you get lost, you'll always know which direction you should go."
Bertie thanked him effusively.
"You're really kind, Ranald," he said. "I wish I could give you something in return, but I don't really have much stuff."
"I'd noticed that," said Ranald. "But don't worry, Bertie. When you get older, you might have more stuff, and then you can give me some of it. I'll keep a note of what I give you so that you'll know how much stuff you have to give me."
That struck Bertie as perfectly fair, and it made it easier for him to accept the compass that Ranald had passed on. There was a small instruction booklet that came with it, and this explained the points of direction and gave a short note on magnetic deviation. For Bertie, though, the real point of having a compass was to know which way was west, as west was important to him in more ways than one. Directly west of the Steiner School, only one block away, was George Watson's College, where Ranald Braveheart MacPherson was a pupil, and where Bertie had spent a brief time, not quite a whole day, in a plum-coloured school blazer to which he wasn't entitled. That day had ended ignominiously when he'd been pushed to the ground and roundly kicked on the rugby field, an experience that had prompted him to run back to the Steiner School, where rugby was blessedly unknown.
beyond Watson's, over Craiglee Ridge, and a touch more to the south than to the west, lay the Pentland Hills, where Bertie had once gone fishing with his father, and where, after they'd been lost in a suddenly descending haar, they'd ended up seeking directions at a farmhouse. Had Bertie had his compass, he felt, he wouldn't have been lost in the first place, but that would have meant that he would never have met the farmer's son, Andy, with whom he'd established immediate and deep rapport. So a compass, he decided, like so many things in this life, brought both advantages and disadvantages. Yet the west still called, and called strongly, because in that direction lay what to Bertie was the promised land. Glasgow. No matter how constrained he might feel in Edinburgh, no matter how trapped in the programme of yoga and psychotherapy planned for him by his mother, there was always Glasgow, an irresistible presence, rather like a great lighthouse in the darkness sending out its pulsating message, "This is Glasgow calling." And surely, readier than all the others to answer the call of Glasgow was Bertie. Glasgow was freedom. Glasgow was excitement. Glasgow was a yoga and psychotherapy-free zone. But in Edinburgh that morning, the members of Bertie's class had been given the task of writing a list.
"Lists are very important," said the teacher, Miss Campbell. "We use them for all sorts of purposes. Can anybody think of the sort of lists people make?"
She surveyed the class. There were a few thoughtful expressions, but no hands went up. Then Olive put up her hand.
"Mummies make lists of things for daddies to do," she volunteered.
Miss Campbell hesitated. The staff tried, as far as possible, to avoid role stereotypes, but sometimes these seemed so accurately to reflect what happened in real life.
"Well, that's true," she said, "but daddies may also make lists of things for mummies to do, don't you think?"
Olive shook her head.
"Not in my experience, Miss Campbell. Mummies don't need these lists because they're the ones who decide what needs to be done. So those things are already in their heads, you see."
Miss Campbell gritted her teeth. She was all for equality in relations between the sexes, but she found it very hard to agree with Olive on anything. She had no desire to encourage her, and agreement might simply urge her on. A further thought had occurred to Olive.
"Of course, I suppose you might not know about that sort of thing, Miss Campbell, since you don't have a husband, do you?"
Miss Campbell closed her eyes and mentally counted to 10, in Gaelic. She'd heard about the reason for the dismissal of Elspeth Harmony, who had pinched Olive's ear in full view of the rest of the class. At the time, she had been shocked by what seemed a completely unacceptable lapse in professional standards, but now she was not so sure. It must have been immensely satisfying to pinch Olive, and as she thought of this, she felt the thumb and index finger of her right hand move slightly apart as if in readiness for just such an attack. But she could never do that, of course, whatever the provocation, whatever the temptation. And so she finished counting up to 10 in Gaelic, and then opened her eyes again. Pansy now joined in.
"Of course, somebody might ask her to marry him, Olive."
And then to Miss Campbell she said,
"Has anybody ever asked you to marry him, Miss Campbell? And if not, do you think anybody might?"
Bertie turned to Pansy.
"You shouldn't ask that sort of thing, Pansy," he said, "and I bet nobody's ever going to ask you or Olive."
This brought a cheer from Tofu.
"You bet they won't," he called out. "Unless they're mad, of course. They might get somebody from the loony bin."
Olive drew in her breath.
"Did you hear that, Miss Campbell? Did you hear what Tofu just said? He called the Royal Edinburgh Hospital the loony bin." "You shouldn't say that, Tofu," said Miss Campbell reproachfully. "Make him stand in the corner," said Pansy, "for 2 hours, Miss Campbell." "Shall I hit him for you?" asked Larch. "I think we need to return to lists," said Miss Campbell. "Let me suggest a list we could all make, and shall do so right now. a list of all the things we're grateful for."
The members of the class exchanged glances, but jotters were taken from desks and pencils readied.
"Number one," wrote Bertie. "Mummy and Daddy."
Then he paused. He so wanted to cross out Mummy, but he couldn't. He just couldn't.
Chapter 5. Glencoe Again. Miss Campbell's eye alighted on Bertie. Of all the children in the class, she imagined that Bertie would be the one who would best understand gratitude, and it was for this reason that she picked him to read out his list.
"We shall start with Bertie," she announced. "We're all interested to hear your list of the things you're grateful for, Bertie. I wonder what they'll be."
She paused.
"We shall soon see, shall we not? Please read us your list, Bertie."
Bertie's heart sank.
"Couldn't we hear Tofu's list first, Miss Campbell?"
he asked.
"Ha!" said Tofu. "You can't, because my list has got nothing in it." "Stupid!" crowed Olive. "You hear that, Miss Campbell? Tofu's not grateful for anything. That's because everybody hates him. If everybody hates you, there's nothing to be grateful for."
Miss Campbell looked disapprovingly at Olive.
"Hush, Olive dear. That's not a very nice thing to say." "But it's true," persisted Olive. "Some of the girls have already got a list, Miss Campbell. It's a list of horrid boys, and Tofu's at the top of it because everybody hates him."
"I don't care," said Tofu.
"They hate you, Olive, more than they hate me. I've seen lists with your name at the top and Pansy second. There are bags of lists like that."
This brought a squeal of protest from Pansy.
"They don't hate me, Miss Campbell. People don't hate me."
"Of course they don't, Pansy," said Miss Campbell, reassuringly.
Turning to Tofu, she administered a stern warning.
"Tofu, you are not to say things like that. I won't have talk in this classroom with people hating one another. Is that quite clear?"
That brought a sullen nod of assent.
"Right," said Miss Campbell. "Now, let's think more positively. Bertie is going to read us his list of things that he's grateful for in his life, and I, for one, am very eager to hear it."
An air of expectation filled the classroom as Bertie unfolded his piece of paper.
"Things I'm Grateful For by Bertie Pollock," he said. "A very good start," said Miss Campbell. "Please carry on, Bertie."
"Number one," said Bertie. "My mummy and daddy."
Miss Campbell clapped her hands together.
"Well, isn't that a lovely beginning, boys and girls? I think it is, because we all know that without our mummy and daddy, none of us would be here. So it's quite right to be grateful for mummy and daddy."
"Or a donor," muttered Tofu.
Miss Campbell's eyes widened.
"Did you say something, Tofu?"
Tofu shook his head.
"Nothing, Miss Campbell."
Miss Campbell hesitated. There was some territory best left unexplored, and this was an example of that. She turned again to Bertie.
"Please carry on, Bertie. What's next on your list?"
Bertie looked at the paper.
"Number two," he continued. "I'm grateful I live in Scotland."
Miss Campbell smiled.
"Now, isn't that nice, boys and girls? Bertie is grateful that he lives in Scotland. It's very important to be proud of your country, boys and girls. Not proud in a silly, boastful sense, but grateful for all that your country gives you."
Olive looked doubtful. Her hand went up. Miss Campbell tried to ignore her, but she was insistent.
"Yes, Olive."
Olive looked accusingly at Bertie as she voiced her objection.
"But what about England?" she said. "Not everybody comes from Scotland." "That's true, Olive," said Miss Campbell. "But Bertie wasn't talking about England. Bertie happens to be a Scottish boy, and so he was talking, quite understandably, about Scotland.
Olive was not to be easily put off.
Yes, but there are some people from England in this class. Hiawatha, for instance. He's English. He was born in England, you see.
Hiawatha frowned.
I can't help that, Olive. Nobody asked me where I wanted to be born.
Olive looked at Hiawatha tolerantly.
I know you can't help that, Hiawatha. I was only thinking of how you must have felt when Bertie went on about being Scottish. You must have felt really small, sort of unwanted.
Hiawatha didn't reply. Pansy, however, always standing by in her role as Olive's principal lieutenant, voiced her agreement.
Yes, poor Hiawatha, she said, sitting there being English.
Bertie felt that he needed to explain.
I didn't mean to say anything about being English, he protested. I like English people. I wouldn't want to say anything nasty. Did not mean, said Olive with heavy sarcasm. Lots of people say things they don't mean to say, but still say them.
Miss Campbell felt it was time to return to the subject.
That's enough, Olive. I think we should get back to Bertie. I was only trying to protect others from being hurt, said Olive. I was only thinking of Hiawatha's feelings.
She paused.
But there's something else, Miss Campbell.
The teacher sighed.
What is it, Olive? My dad says that we shouldn't be too pleased with ourselves. He said that we should always remember the bad things that have happened in Scottish history.
Miss Campbell nodded.
I think that's quite right, Olive. I think we should always take a balanced view.
Olive was now in her stride.
Such as the massacre of Glencoe. My dad thinks we shouldn't forget that. No, we shouldn't,
echoed Pansy, trying hard to remember what the massacre of Glencoe was all about. Larch, who had been largely silent, now joined in.
Yes, he said, we should remember what the English did at Glencoe.
He stared at Hiawatha as he spoke. Larch was violent, and a historical casus belli was as good as anything else.
The English! Exploded Olive. It wasn't the English, Larch. You obviously know nothing about Scottish history. It was the...
She paused. There was complete silence in the classroom.
It was the Campbells!
All eyes turned to Miss Campbell, who laughed nervously.
There may be some truth in that, she said, but we must remember, boys and girls, that it was a long time ago that the Campbells fell upon the MacDonalds. In their own house, contributed Olive, after the MacDonalds had given them their tea. It was a very long time ago, repeated Miss Campbell.
There was a further silence, eventually broken by Olive.
"Was your grandfather there, Miss Campbell?"
she asked.
Chapter 6 Unsettling Thoughts. Domenica MacDonald, anthropologist and resident of Scotland Street, was now Domenica Lordy. Or was she? Domenica may have married Angus Lordy, portrait painter and stalwart of the Scottish Arts Club, but that did not mean that she had ceased to be who she was, which was Domenica, daughter of the late Patrick Ochterlony MacDonald and Euphemia Constance MacDonald of Scrimgeour. Identity was a complex matter, but one thing was clear. In Scotland, you did not automatically change your name to that of your husband, and there was certainly no legal requirement to that effect. Domenica had been happy enough to be married, but didn't feel that it was the defining feature of her life. Angus was her second husband. Her first, whom she'd met and married in South India, had been a mild and rather unmemorable man, a member of a family who owned what they referred to as an electricity factory outside Cochin. This business, a small coal-fired generating station, had been her husband's pride and joy, but it had also been the cause of his death by electrocution. Widowhood had saved her from a restrictive marriage. She'd loved her first husband, vaguely, but she hadn't been in love with him. There was a distinction, she felt, between the state of loving another and being in love. The latter involved a surrender to a state of incompleteness. The object of your love was necessary for your continued existence, or so you thought. Loving another was wanting to own that person, to have him or her as completely as possible. You appended the other to your life. You incorporated him within your immediate personal world. As an anthropologist, she'd spent her entire professional life trying to understand people, how they behaved, and why they did what they did. The scientific study of human society answered some of those questions, but said nothing at all about why we liked the things we did. So an anthropologist might work out how people organize their private lives, might throw light on patterns of courtship and marriage, which were matters of love, after all, but might have nothing to say about the thing that was at the core of all that, about the mystery of love. Nor did psychology throw much light on what made people experience love for another. The psychologist might understand the place of love in the pantheon of emotions, but may say nothing about what it actually was. It was the same with consciousness. We understood how consciousness might come into existence, and neuroscience claimed even to have pinpointed the region of the brain that appeared to weld mental activity into an awareness of self. But an understanding of the fundamental notion of consciousness continued to evade philosophers. Love was like that. It happened, and it made a big difference. But what it actually was, what its wellsprings were, was a question that philosophers had yet to answer. Domenica was not sure if she loved Angus. She was fond of him, of course, but fondness was not the same thing as love. Fondness never set the pulse racing. Fondness never made you ache inside, hopelessly, sometimes deliriously, as love so effortlessly did. Yet if anybody were to ask her, "Do you love your husband?" she would have replied without hesitation, "Of course I do." And that, more or less, was what she had publicly professed on that rather fraught day when she had stood with Angus in St. Mary's Episcopal Cathedral and exchanged vows. She'd promised to love him because the wording of the 1929 marriage service had been explicit on that point. But how could one promise to love somebody? You might promise to treat him lovingly, which is something that anybody should be capable of, but you could not promise that the bird of love, that shy, elusive creature, would alight on your particular bough. And so far, she felt that she had kept her promise, and she thought he had too. They'd treated one another with kindness and consideration. They'd exchanged few angry words, and when they had immediately regretted them. They made one another breakfast, turn and turn about. They ironed each other's clothes. They bought small presents that they presented to one another at odd times. She was contented. But could she say that she loved him? Possibly, as long as love was defined broadly enough to include the comfortable friendship that comes with being in another's company over time. She looked across the kitchen in Scotland Street. Angus was sitting on a rickety chair, one that had belonged to Domenica's grandmother and had been taken from that distant croft on North Uist when she'd died. In Domenica's eyes, the chair was a link with that old Scottish past that seemed to be vanishing so quickly. An object that should have been in a museum somewhere, but was, instead, here in her house. How unnoticed and how speedily might a whole culture slip away from a people. The Gaelic voices of Domenica's youth had largely disappeared. Those liquid vowels, that soft and entrancing language that could sound like the falling of rain, that had become almost rare, and been replaced by the very different tones of incomers, the flattened vowels of Yorkshire, the chirpy, half-swallowed patois of London. And with the withering of language had gone the stories and the attitudes, the unspoken understandings, the subtle references that had made up the distinctive life of Scotland. That might go slowly, its passage almost unnoticed, until suddenly you were reminded that the person to whom you were talking didn't know what you meant. She smiled. She was remembering what had happened a few days ago when she'd wanted to go to a concert at the Canongate Kirk, and had telephoned to book a taxi to collect her. "I'd like to go to the Canongate Kirk," she'd said. The voice at the end of the line had hesitated and then said, "Is that a restaurant?" Domenica had laughed, but it was a laugh that concealed a sudden twinge of despair. A voice on the telephone, a local voice, did not know the word kirk, anglice, church, which was one of the very commonest Scots words. She looked at Angus. An important part of love was the sharing of some valued possession. A tune. Listen, they're playing our tune. Children, perhaps, a fund of stories, a country. They had all of that, she thought, but still. And now it came to her, that awful, unsettling question. Did she want to stay with Angus for the rest of her life? If she did, then she knew that this would preclude any passionate involvement. Angus represented friendship and companionship, but was that all that she wanted? She gasped with shock at her own disloyalty. Angus looked up. He thought she'd sneezed. "Bless you," he muttered. She looked away, ashamed and perturbed in equal measure. Chapter 7. Grateful for You. For Angus, if there was an emotional key to his marriage, it was gratitude. He'd been a bachelor for longer than most. He and Domenica had married when they were both in their late 40s, and he'd felt the relief and gratitude that often accompanies a marriage at that time of life. The relief that came from the assuaging of that niggling doubt that one of life's milestones was yet to be passed. Others, of course, being the driving test, the first session of root canal treatment, the payment of the last installment of the mortgage, the first colonoscopy, the marriage of one's firstborn child, and the last examination that one will ever be obliged to take. With marriage came the feeling that one had answered an expectation that others had of one, even if that expectation was tactfully never articulated. One was expected to settle down, to forswear freedom, to assume a commitment to somebody else. All of this may have been watered down to an extent by the recognition of less formal arrangements, but it was still there. Angus fully understood that people wanted other people to find another person with whom to settle down. Why should they want this? One explanation was that those who were free of commitments of this sort were an affront to those who were encumbered. If people were going to have to knuckle under to the bringing up of children, with all it entails in terms of personal sacrifice, then why should some avoid this and continue to be free? Another, more generous explanation lay in the desire that people have for others to be happy. It was assumed that everybody without somebody would be happier if the situation were to be changed. This was a notion of completeness, that a moiety requires, by its very nature, to be united with its missing part. Angus had had his involvements, of course. As a young man, there had been a succession of girlfriends, but they'd drifted away when they sensed that he was just too preoccupied with his painting to give much thought to committing to any of them. He had treated them well, but it had been as if he were not entirely there in the relationship. And then, as the years went past, he became progressively more covered in paint, as if he were somehow stepping into one of his paintings. He took less trouble with his clothes, all of which were flecked with oil paint of various, sometimes non-matching hues. It was not very romantic to be embraced by somebody who would leave patches of paint on one's blouse, or who, when running his fingers appreciatively through one's hair, would leave paint there as well.
"My friends think I've been highlighting," complained one girlfriend. "But it's you, Angus. You leave paint on everything you touch, including my hair. A Midas of the pigments."
"I have to paint," said Angus. "It's what I do."
Nor did women, by and large, find the smell of turpentine all that attractive. And when Angus adopted Cyril, who was by general repute one of the more malodorous dogs in Edinburgh, the flow of women callers to his studio dried to a trickle and then became a drought. He didn't mind too much. He had a social circle that consisted of painters and sculptors. He was a regular at the Scottish Arts Club, which had passed a special bylaw to allow Cyril to enter the premises as an associate member. He had been elected a member of the Royal Scottish Academy, and he was on the committee of the Scottish Artists Benevolent Association, the body that distributed largesse, small s, as Angus called it, in view of the limited nature of the fund, to struggling artists. He had his routine, which included visits to Big Lou's Café during the day and to the Cumberland Bar in the early evening, where Cyril would be given a complimentary bowl of stout to drink under one of the tables. He could have continued with this life had it not been for his meeting Domenica and his appreciation of her conversation, of her wit, and of the sheer pleasure that he took in being in her company. When she agreed to marry him, he felt a gratitude more profound than any he had felt before. It took his breath away. "Me? She has consented to share her life with me?" It was a feeling that all modest people have when it suddenly dawns on them that somebody likes them. His happiness brought changes in his life. The paint-bespattered outfits were disposed of, and an entire new wardrobe of clothes obtained from Stuart Christie and Company in Queen Street. 4 pairs of moleskin trousers, 2 waistcoats, 1 olive green and another mustard, 3 jackets of Harris tweed in a cut far nattier than anything he'd worn before, a new pair of tartan trews in Macpherson tartan, a pair of Dubarry boots into which the legs of the moleskin trousers could be tucked to particularly dashing effect. Even Cyril benefited from this makeover, being fitted with a new collar and put on a course of charcoal pills to tackle his social issues. The transformation was complete and, in a strange way, liberating. Familiar routines, old clothes, habits of the years can be like chains. Cast them off and one's step is lighter, nimbler, less restricted to the piste created by the past.
"You're a new man, Angus," observed Matthew in the Cumberland Bar one evening. "Marriage obviously agrees with you."
"Oh, it does," said Angus. "I'm happy to see you, Matthew."
Matthew nodded. He wondered how many people ever said to themselves, "I'm happy." And did it help to contemplate one's own happiness?
"Do you think," he asked Angus, "that happiness is something you can create within yourself just by saying, 'I'm happy'?"
Angus looked about the bar, at the familiar faces of the other patrons.
"Do you like Hopper?"
he asked Matthew. He was thinking of the picture of the people lined up at a counter.
"Of course," answered Matthew. "His paintings—"
Angus interrupted him.
"Nighthawks?"
Matthew nodded.
"The people in the diner. The chef in the white hat."
"The most powerful portrayal of loneliness in art," said Angus.
"Yes," said Matthew. "But the thing about Hopper's paintings is that they provide us with the view that God must have of the scene, if he exists, of course."
"We can still talk about God, even if he doesn't exist," said Angus. "God, as an idea, makes perfect sense. We can paint things, you know, that don't exist. The wind, for example."
He looked at Matthew as if to challenge him to deny that one might not depict the invisible through the effect that it has on the visible. Chapter 8. Headhunting. Domenica put the disloyal thoughts out of her mind, at least for the moment. In due course they would return, and return more troublingly. For the present, though, she was more concerned with a letter she'd received from the Department of Social Anthropology at the university. Domenica was not on the department's staff, but organized occasional seminars for their postgraduate students, or would lecture the undergraduate students if one of the full-time staff was on leave. Her lectures were popular, particularly one she would from time to time deliver on the subject of headhunting in Papua New Guinea. Like so many anthropologists, Domenica had at an earlier stage of her career undertaken fieldwork amongst remote tribes of the New Guinea Highlands. These people, who were so accustomed to anthropologists that they had a separate guest house in the village reserved for visiting professors, were generally hostile to their neighbours, against whom they had in the past conducted regular headhunting raids. In a rough-hewn cabinet in the main meeting house, a low, dark building thatched with local reeds, there was a collection of small, shrunken objects, wizened with age. It was explained to the visiting anthropologists that these were human heads, and that each one represented a successful raid on a neighbouring tribe with whom there were ancient disputes, going back, the headman assured visitors, to the time before the earth had entirely cooled and the land taken its current shape. This tribal cosmology had greatly impressed visitors, particularly a succession of American anthropologists who came from the University of Louisiana in Baton Rouge, and their German counterparts from the Institut für Sozialanthropologie und Empirische Kulturwissenschaften in Hamburg. For her part, Domenica was skeptical, and in the 6 months she spent living with the group in question, had set out to examine in a more critical way the claims that were made in relation to headhunting. Her suspicions were aroused by the difficulty she encountered in finding any member of the group who had actually engaged in a headhunting raid. There were plenty of uncles, now safely deceased, who were said to have been accomplished headhunters, and various cousins, since relocated to Port Moresby, who had a reputation for major hauls of heads. Death and distance prevented either of these categories from attesting to their exploits, but this had somehow been overlooked by previous anthropologists. Domenica thought that this might be because to have been exposed to headhunting had a certain cachet that research in the libraries of North America or Germany simply did not confer. After being shown the preserved heads in the meeting house, Domenica had managed to pick the primitive lock that prevented access to the homemade display case in which they were stored. She did this privately, when nobody was around, and when her hosts imagined that she would be safely in bed. Shielding the beam of her torch with a cupped hand, she gingerly extracted the first of the heads, a tiny, shriveled object the size of a large grapefruit or pineapple. A tuft of hair protruded from the top, and it was by this that she held the head while she examined it more closely. There were two sockets where the eyes must have been, and a short protuberance that would have been the victim's nose. The ears were flattened against the side of the head, sad, dejected flaps of skin that must once have heard birdsong, the singing of children, the sound of waterfalls. She looked more closely. There was something odd about this head, and as she ran her hand down the back of it, she encountered unexpected ridges and something sharp that pricked at her finger. She almost dropped it, imagining the dormant viruses that might live on a shrunken head like this until a careless anthropologist came and picked it up. That was what had happened to those Egyptologists, was it not? Those unapologetic tomb raiders who had, with the blessing of Western scholarly academies, broken into dusty pyramid chambers and disturbed the rest of ancient pharaohs. They had all died in mysterious circumstances,
some from unexplained diseases which could well have been triggered by microbes, for which a millennium or two of seclusion was but nothing. These heads could similarly be host to such organisms, except that the ridges and the prickles gave it away. These were, in fact, shrunken pineapples, cleverly made up to appear like shrunken heads.